Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that gives us an opportunity to meet people who make a difference in our communities and in our lives. I'm your host, Bob Willard, and today our guest is Benjamin Bagby, troubadour, vocalist, harpist, scholar, and founder of the early music group Sequentia. He's in Bloomington as a part of the 2000-2001 Patton Lecture Series. For the next hour or so, we will ask him a few questions, play some music, and meet the person behind the persona. Ben, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, Ben, let me introduce you to our listeners by mentioning some of your accomplishments. Benjamin Bagby is one of the world's most respected performers in the areas of medieval music, individually as a singer, harpist, and scholar, and as co-founder of one of the world's most popular medieval musical ensembles, Sequentia. He has had an active interest in early music since boyhood and has for the past quarter of a century dedicated himself almost exclusively to the research, performance, and recording of music written before 1500. As an actor and musician, he has created a one-man performance of the epic Danish poem Beowulf, which he performs in the original Anglo-Saxon, with subtitles. It is a lecture performance of this ancient tale that has brought him to Bloomington and the Patton Lectures. Ben, what was the genesis of your lifelong love for medieval music?
The genesis was probably, as with so many young boys, a concert experience. I went to a concert of the old New York Pro Musica, which was flourishing in the 1960s when I was a kid. And I had heard early music before. I'd heard Bach, I'd heard madrigals, and the usual thing you hear in high school, but I had never before encountered the music of the 13th century. And to be plunged into that environment suddenly utterly mystified me. And by the time the concert was over, I was just burning with desire to know what was this music and where did these musicians find it and how did they know what to do with it. And so I began scratching around in a very primitive way in libraries and asking teachers, musicologists, historians to help me find source material to study it on my own. And after a few months of that, I had already formed my first ensemble. And within, I think, 4 or 5 months, we were already giving concerts, which are pretty painful to think about now. But at the time, it was almost like a need, an almost physical need, to get involved with that music.
How old were you at this time?
16.
And it was the New York Pro Musica, Noah Greenberg, and it wasn't happened to be the play of Daniel.
No, in fact, it was a few years after Noah Greenberg had died. At that time, John White was the conductor.
Right.
And I had gone to a summer music school actually to sing Bach and other classical pieces and to work on German Lied. And to sing in a chorus under Robert Shaw, that was the thing that drew me to this school. And there was running at the same time a course being taught by the Pro Musica, and I just happened to go to this concert.
And at the age when most kids are listening to, at that time, rock and roll, you're singing 15th century, 10th century music.
Yeah, well, I was a social outcast, there's no doubt about it.
Well, you said you had an ensemble. Where did you find the rest of the players?
Well, there were just enough weird people in my high school, and I was able to convince them that this was something important that they needed to do.
And you sang, and did you play an instrument?
Yeah, at that time I was playing the lute, actually, because of an earlier childhood fascination with the five-string banjo.
Of course, it's just a direct descent.
Yeah, right? It turns out the technique of the banjo comes in very handy for playing medieval harp, but I didn't know that at the time.
When this interest started, the whole early music movement was in its infancy. There was Alfred Deller and David Monroe and, of course, Noah Greenberg. How did you feed and nurture this musical need? Where did you find the places to perform or to find the music outside of the library?
At this time, I was lucky to be in a high school that was very oriented towards music and drama, and the teachers there were extremely helpful to me, even in organizing my ensemble and finding concert venues and putting their resources at my disposal, which is pretty amazing for a school to do that for a 16-year-old. But I was extremely motivated in those days. Another thing which is important to remember is that we didn't live in the 60s in a kind of information age. There wasn't ready access to sources. You had to really do some snooping around to find anything. And it wasn't that easy to penetrate libraries. I lived near Northwestern University, so I was able to utilize their library resources. But really, the biggest inspiration came through hearing concerts of groups that were on tour. The Promusica was often passing through. There was, of course, Thomas Binkley's ensemble, the early music quartet, which toured in the States at least once a year. And then, of course, it was the old LPs that we would go down and search out in our local record store, sometimes quite by chance, especially those European imports, which back in the 60s seemed very exotic and learned and somehow better than anything we had here. We would really greedily listen to those old recordings and wonder how they knew to do what they were doing. It was all a big mystery at that time. But I think a combination of the school I was enrolled in and the access to recordings and the closeness to a university music library all helped me very much, with performing groups coming through.
Was this like a high school of the arts or something?
Almost, yeah. It's a high school that had a big emphasis on the arts, and they even had a whole building devoted to music and drama, and I basically spent my high school years hanging out in that one building.
Well, did your parents understand all this?
Yes and no. They had some trepidation because my older brother is a jazz musician. And, of course, the jazz musician's life is not the same as the classical musician's life. And I think they were a little bit alarmed that both brothers were going to be heading towards music. But I think by the time I was 17, it was pretty clear that that's the way it was going to be.
But were they musical?
No, not really. My dad was a great singer in his youth, but more on an amateur level.
But your brother went to jazz,
yeah,
and you went to 10th century,
yes,
music. Do they interconnect?
They do in some respects. When he comes to one of my concerts or hears one of my records, he's always struck by the modality of the systems that organize tones. In jazz, of course, there's an enormous influence exercised by modal thought, by modal organization. And so we can talk on a common ground about things like that.
Well, improvisation.
To some extent, although I think the word improvisation is vastly overrated as it's applied to what I do, because true improvisation is not really going on in the level it is in jazz.
Well, you said you wanted to be a jazz announcer. You told me that earlier.
Yeah, yeah. A jazz DJ, because of the that feeling of insomniac late night people listening to the radio, and that sort of brotherhood of people who stay up very late, which I belong to.
So you could sit there and sort of mumble about,
yeah,
where this recording was made, and
yeah, jazz arcana, and it kind of fits with the whole jazz milieu, a sort of sleepless nighttime crowd.
Well, you could do that for early music,
probably. Although there, I think the number of listeners would dwindle to a mere handful.
Well, from high school then, you went to Oberlin.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? And did they have the facility there to get into the early music scene?
Yes. In fact, that's one of the reasons I chose Oberlin. I actually had been considering coming to Indiana University as a young high school singer. And I eventually went to Oberlin, for a variety of reasons, but one of them was the access to early music, which was being pursued rather vigorously there at that time. There have since, while I was a student there, even the Baroque Music Institute started at Oberlin. And I was attracted to the fact that it's a very small school, and it's a place where you can do very concentrated work in an extremely isolated and non-distracting environment. And they had an excellent library for a small liberal arts school, and it's a college as well as a conservatory. I could not have done what I was interested in doing if I had just gone to a pure conservatory of music.
So you got the voice training at the conservatory, but you also had a degree, have a degree in German from the college.
Yes, right.
I understand you presented, and I'm not going to sure if I'm going to get this accurate, a paper regarding a medieval drinking song while you were in college that turned into an American patriotic number.
That's close. No, I didn't do a paper. The paper was someone else's work. But I profited very much from this paper. In my, you know, when you finish your studies at Oberlin, you have to give a final recital. And there are certain requirements for the repertoire in the final recital. It has to have some French opera, some Italian opera, some German lead, some of this and that, and something in English. And it's always nice to throw in something American if you can. And usually, of course, people then sing something from Puccini, some Mozart, some Schubert, and my recital was only early music. And they were the voice faculty, of course, was really up in arms about this. But I had gotten by on a technicality because the French opera was a French Baroque opera. The Italian opera was Monteverdi. The English songs were lute songs. And the German lead was songs by a 15th century German composer, etc., etc. In other words, there was nothing after the 18th century. But, you know, technically met all the requirements. And the last piece on that concert was a very well-known 18th century drinking song called To Anacreon in Heaven.
To an Anacreon?
To Anacreon, the god Anacreon.
Oh, okay.
In Heaven. And it's about the merging, let's see, how does it go? Merging the arts of Venus, the arts of love, with the vine of Bacchus, the god of wine. So it's about love and wine and the joys of the cup and all that.
Relatively earthy stuff.
Yeah. Phrased, of course, in beautiful 18th century English, rhyming couplets. But the melody to this song, it was a popular drinking song tune known far and wide in the 18th century. It's the tune which was later adopted to fit the poem of our national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner. And this thing that we know as, Oh, Say, Can You See, was actually called To Anacreon in Heaven. And, of course, over the years, it's become a kind of a gooey, slushy thing that is sung at baseball games and in a million different musical styles. But I tried to take it back to the style it would have been sung in the 18th century with its original text. And with a little instrumental ensemble and a chorus to sing the refrain. And I didn't really say anything about the Star-Spangled Banner. I just presented it very straightforward for what it is. And it's amazing that really not everybody in the audience recognized the song. There's something familiar about it, but they didn't really recognize it. And that's been that was recorded because all recitals were recorded and still are at Oberlin. But somebody at that classical music station in Cleveland, WCLV, got their hands on a tape of this, and it's something they play now every 4th of July on the radio. And so I'm constantly getting calls from people saying, oh, I heard you sing on the radio last week in Cleveland. And this is from 1974.
Ben, it wasn't too many years after you left Oberlin that you founded Sequentia. Before we talk about that, do you have any selection we could hear from that group so that we're familiar with it?
Yes, I think the most interesting and certainly the most well-known work we've done in the last 15 years has been with the music of Hildegard von Bingen, a 12th century abbess and composer, mystic and writer. And we're in the process of recording her complete works. There are just 10 more pieces to be recorded before that project is finished. And so because it's symptomatic of what our group has been doing over the last couple of decades, I thought we could listen to a solo sung by Barbara Thornton, who founded Sequentia with me in 77, of a piece by Hildegard von Bingen, O Magne Pater, from a CD called Saints.
We have just heard a selection written by Hildegard von Bingen, performed by Sequentia, a group founded by our guest today, Benjamin Bagby, medievalist, who is in Bloomington to give a performance of Beowulf and a lecture demonstration of Beowulf, the singer of tales and the genesis of a performance. This is part of the patent lecture series of 2000-2001. You must have been in the vanguard of the Hildegard phenomenon.
It turns out that way. It didn't seem like it at the time. Hildegard was fairly well known in scholarly communities and also in the Benedictine community. She was, of course, a big personality. And so we didn't feel that we were discovering her by any means. She was well known to many, many people, especially in Germany. However, no one had really been interested in pursuing her music as serious music. It was thought of as something, a poor cousin of Gregorian chant, for instance. A late repertoire. 12th century is very, very late when seen in the light of Gregorian chant, which is quite, quite ancient. And we were the first ensemble really to try to reconstruct what would have been a singing school in Hildegard's abbey, a Benedictine abbey on the Rhine in the 12th century. The women and girls who formed a part of that abbey were from the best families in the area. Those were women from noble families. As such, they came with an enormous cultural training, with an enormous sense of expectation of the beautiful things in life. Even though they were living a spiritual life in a monastic community, Hildegard's writings and descriptions of life in that monastery and her music and its texts witness to an extremely refined sensibility for sounds, for music, for the sense of time and how time passes musically. And it interested us to recreate a vocal ensemble such as Hildegard would have known in her time, a highly virtuosic and blended ensemble that was also attuned to the texts that Hildegard had created, which are surprisingly brilliant mystical texts. They're not simple religious texts, devotional texts. They are mystical and quite difficult to understand even. Her Latin is very, very brilliant and colorful. Her images are sometimes surprising, and she even uses words from a language that she created, something called the unknown language, and Hermetic system of words, which describe things that only people in that group could understand. And so that was certainly the main focus of the women's ensemble, which was directed by Barbara Thornton all those years. And it blossomed into a project to record the complete works, which includes a music drama and 77 songs. But at the time, whether we were in the vanguard or not didn't really interest us all that much. There was, of course, another ensemble in England called Gothic Voices, which had also made a recording about the same time as our first recording. They basically came out at the same time, but we were unaware of one another at the time. In retrospect, we now talk about it being in the vanguard, but at the time we thought, well, this will be something we'll do once and that will be the end of it.
Well, I can recall recently on the radio here at WFIU, they played a listing of some of the most famous composers, and Hildegard was one of them. And where it started with a minute group of people interested, now it's become, in the classical music field, a fairly well-known series of works. Hasn't that sold like 500,000 copies
or
something?
Yes.
Which is unheard of even for Verdi and Puccini. I mean, that's pretty remarkable.
Well, that was a phenomenon at that time. In the mid-90s, there was this, you'll recall, I'm sure, this enormous vogue for Gregorian chant, which was not necessarily linked to people being interested in Gregorian chant. It had to do with the marketing concept of one particular record called chant, which stimulated a huge market, youth market, basically, that was basically interested in disco and rave and techno music. And the chant came as a kind of what they described as a chill factor in the rave scene. Once they saw that that was selling, and indeed it sold unbelievably well, everybody jumped on the bandwagon. And now the Gregorian chant section in the record shops is bigger than the whole early music section put together.
Well, you got some good fallout from it.
A little bit, yeah. But, it blew itself out, of course. After a few years, it was passé. And now, of course, chant sales have dwindled back to what they were before.
But there's still new recordings of Hildegard coming out.
Yeah, that's also linked to the fact that her 900th birthday was in 1998. And basically every ensemble that was involved with medieval music did something to recognize that, either through a concert or a performance or a recording. And many, many new recordings came out in that year. Of course, saturating again the market to the point where nobody actually profited from it at all.
Well, what is it about hers, the music that she wrote, that speaks more to the listener than other music written at the same time?
She had a very personal and unique melodic language. When you listen to a piece by Hildegard von Bingen, you know immediately that it's her and it can't possibly be anyone else. Many other compositions from the period, and I must say most of them were anonymous. Hildegard is one of the few names of a composer that we have from this time. Most of the other pieces created at that time, we're talking here about the 12th century in Germany, are coming from a more generic, functionally oriented musical production of anonymous composers. And they use texts which are, to some extent, quite repetitive and based on models and previous usage and kind of filling in the blanks with whatever saint we're singing about on a given day. But Hildegard's language is always extremely personal, and her musical settings of those very personal texts are always very precise. And she obviously she described it herself as a visionary relationship to her creation. She didn't think of it as an artistic creation, that she would sit down and create this thing. She thought of herself as a medium, a conduit through which a divinely inspired music and text was channeled. And so she wasn't really thinking of herself as the composer in the 19th century sense of the genius composer. She was simply an instrument, even using that Latin word, instrumentum, that thing through which the energy is passing. So when we listen to her pieces, we always sense and hear that it's her unique musical language.
Do you think we could hear one more piece of hers before we go on with the discussion today?
Yes, this is another one of her so-called symphonie, which is a song. They have various forms, liturgical forms. This is called O Felix Anima. It's incorporated into our second recording of Hildegard's play, Ordo Virtutum, and is sung here by the soloist Nancy Mayer.
Thank you.
We have just heard another selection by Hildegard von Bingen. Ben, can you just tell me the name of it again?
It's called O Felix Anima.
I would not get that word out correctly.
Oh, happy soul.
Okay, I like that better. I can handle that one. Well, let's step to Beowulf. How did that whole thing come about?
Beowulf has a long story behind it. It has its origins in my childhood love of Beowulf, which was, of course, given to me as a book, and I read it as a book as a boy, and I was very captivated by the story. I had, of course, no idea and no interest in where it was from or anything about the history of it at that time. I simply knew it as a story. And many, many years later, during the first years of Sequentia, I shared a podium with a speaker at a conference about words and music in the Middle Ages and how they fit together and what we know about texts and musical performances of texts. And there was an Anglo-Saxonist there who was interested in trying to reconstruct the melody for Beowulf. He was convinced that one could reconstruct an actual melody, a notatable melody, since we know that a piece like Beowulf was performed vocally. I don't want to say the word sung because that awakens all kinds of other associations, but it was vocalized in any case. And that began a kind of dialogue with him, which lasted another 7 or 8 years, on the slow burner, definitely. But the impetus to really get going on it came when a harp builder announced that she was building a copy of a 7th-century lyre found in a burial site, which, of course, was fragmented and broken and partially disintegrated. But based on the archaeological find, she was able to reconstruct a playable version of that same instrument. And as soon as I had the instrument in my hands, which was in the mid-80s, I could begin to put together some musical ideas about the realization of Beowulf, and it kind of got going in the late 80s, and then I had a commission from a festival in the Netherlands to perform an entire evening of Beowulf in 1990, and that's when I began seriously doing this work, so about 10 years ago. In the meantime, it's been changing and developing a lot over the years. I don't think if you'd heard the 1990 premiere and what I did here in Bloomington, you would not maybe recognize large sections of it.
Now, is the musical portion of it, what's played, is that reconstructed from found manuscripts or is that from your imagination and your experience?
Neither of those. There are no manuscripts from the Anglo-Saxon times. We have absolutely no musical manuscripts of any performance from that time. And it's not that they're lost, it's that they never existed in the first place. We would have no reason to expect to find a manuscript because these kinds of performances were the domain of bards, of professional storytellers, who were functioning in an oral poetry world, a world of sound and not of writing, and there was no such thing as literature. It was a pre-literate society. The only people who could read or write were monks, who were trained for that purpose, and they were reading and writing generally Latin texts. And musical notation didn't really begin finding its way into manuscripts until very, very late, in the 9th century even. And if Beowulf is from the 7th century, clearly it's from a pre-notation time. But what we do know for a fact is that this instrument was used, that it was played by the person actually performing the story, that person was also singing. We have all that from descriptions from the time. So we know there was singing. We know the instrument was accompanying. We know it was being played. We know what it looked like. We know how many strings it had. You can put a lot of those factors together in a reconstruction and come up with, which was what I did, a hypothetical and plausible tuning for that instrument. The tuning is based on what we know about medieval concepts of harmony, of consonants, and what we know about string technology and very basic things about sheep gut strings and when they break and when they sound good and when they sound bad. And once I had the instrument I was able to see that the issue is not to make melodies. The issue is not to try to reconstruct the tune. The issue is that you have six tones at your disposal, kind of a matrix of tones, and those tones help you to tell the story using modal gesture and little turns which are typical for that mode. It's like learning a language. You learn the word for chair, and then you learn the word for table and sit and go and come and all those basic words, and you start to put together baby sentences, which is what I did. I started to make baby 7th century Beowulf sentences, and they got more and more complex as I got more and more comfortable with them. But from performance to performance, those things can change. They're not fixed. And nowhere have I written anything down. There's no musical score for what I do. I never wrote a note of music for this. It's something that remains flexible in my head. Of course, over the years, I've developed certain ways of telling or singing certain parts of the story. But other parts of the story are really left to the evening, to the mood of the moment. But I don't have to think of what I'm going to do. It comes out of this repertoire of gestures I have at my disposal. And when you look at epic storytelling traditions that use music in other traditions, say in Central Asia or in Africa, or even in the Orient, you see that although they have different tonal systems and different instruments and different stories and different poetic structures, the principle is always the same. That something very simple is being employed, which can be varied and changed and patterned in different ways to propel the story forward. And that's what I'm trying to do with Beowulf.
But you're performing it in the original Danish Anglo-Saxon of the 700s, or the 7th century.
Yeah, the story is certainly from the 7th century. The story takes place in Denmark.
Okay.
It's, you know, the action in the story takes place in Denmark, but the manuscript which preserves the story is in England, and it's in Anglo-Saxon or Old English. And the manuscript is from a later time. The manuscript's from about the year 1000, so it's exactly 1,000 years old. However, it's documenting something that's much older, because manuscripts generally in the Middle Ages are not creations. They are documents of earlier things which are in danger of dying out. And, you know, we're going to forget it. Let's write it down. So it's an English telling of a story that takes place in Denmark. There are no Danes speaking, actually. Everyone speaks English, even though they're Danish. It's certain that there was a Danish version of a Beowulf story at some point, but it just never found its way into writing.
Now, this is not the English we know today.
Oh, no. No, no.
Can you just give us a line or phrase just to...
Well, for instance, when he's talking about in the morning, there was a great rejoicing, and people came from far and wide to see what had happened the night before in the big fight. So he would say, Tha wessan morgen mine ja freya im tha jif hella guthrink modig ferdan an folk tog an ferron an nehan jon win wegas wunder schaujan ladan lastas.
Well, that's perfectly clear.
Yeah. It's a Germanic language. Old English is a Germanic language. It's the English spoken before the Norman invasion.
And there's like 1,200 lines in this thing, and you learned it all?
There are only about 800 in the performance I do. But the whole Beowulf epic is well over 3,000 lines, and I'm doing a bit less than a third of it.
You mean you're only giving them a truncated version?
Yeah, well, the whole thing would last 5 hours.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And this is a labor of love that's become a passion.
Oh, yeah. I would really love to continue it and finish working on the rest of the poem so that I could do that five-hour performance, maybe over a period of 3 days or with two large intermissions. There are three big episodes in the story. But certainly it's my ultimate goal. Whether I live long enough to accomplish that is another matter altogether.
It's better than having nothing to do.
Well, yeah, that's for sure.
Let's step back a bit. We've mentioned several names. We've mentioned particularly Noah Greenberg and Barbara Thornton. But who were your mentors and inspirations as you developed your career?
My inspirations, some of them are people I never met, that I whose recordings I heard or whose concerts I attended. Sometimes those little brushes with another musician can be extremely important. I was very influenced as a young kid, as I said, by people like Robert Shaw, the recordings, and certainly the sensibility of Noah Greenberg, which he passed on to his musicians. Among them was the famous countertenor Russell Oberlin, who was a teacher of mine when I was a teenager. And
well, he also sang with Robert Shaw, too.
Yeah, yeah. Besides, he was part of that whole, there was an enormous cultural, musical flowering in this country, I think, in the late 50s. Enormously important things and interesting things going on all throughout the late 50s and early 60s. It was a very heady time, I think, to be a musician. I'm sorry I was too young to partake of that. Certainly they were an influence. When I went to Switzerland to study at the Schola Cantorum in Basel in Switzerland, after leaving Oberlin, I then came into the orbit of Andrea von Rahm and Thomas Binkley, who were teaching at that time in Switzerland. Their ensemble was still together, still functioning at that time, the Studio der frühen Musik, or called the Early Music Quartet, and worked with him for 3 years, and certainly a very influential time. He had not yet become the very well-known and inspirational educator he was later to become when he came here to the University of Indiana and founded the Early Music Institute. At that time, he was still a performing musician on the road, working in concert halls and not in classrooms. But it was extremely stimulating to be in his presence. And I learned a great deal during my time in Switzerland. Andrea von Rahm, who was his collaborator for many, many years, was very stimulating in pushing young singers to realize that text is music, that there's not something called a text and then there's something called the melody that it's set to, that the text is the music, the melody is not the music. It was an extremely important factor in many, many singers' training. She unfortunately passed away last year. And besides that, I can only point to, for inspiration, people who work with texts, poets, singers in other countries whom I've never met, who perform oral epics, who perform stories, who perform in languages I don't understand, in places like Korea, in Japan, in Africa, who I'm not copying by any means, but I'm allowing myself to be inspired by what they're able to do with vocal usage, with rhetoric, with the way an instrument can help a singer, with the way time can be used in telling a story, and with the different possibilities of the human voice in shaping stories.
It's interesting because even in musical theater today, the statement is, tell the story, don't sing the song.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same tradition.
We can always feel that when we're listening to a singer who has a beautiful voice, even a very beautiful voice, if they're not using that voice in the service of what they're trying to tell us, we are always left with that very self-conscious feeling of listening to a beautiful voice. And the really great singers are the ones, beautiful voice or not, who can make us forget about that and really bring us into the experience of the text itself.
Is that what you strive for in the communication of your performances?
Certainly, that's one of the most important things.
And so Beowulf grabs you and you become a performer, or you are just the vehicle presenting it.
Yeah, I'm also fulfilling several roles simultaneously in the course of the evening. I always feel very conspiratorial with the audience, for instance, that I'm telling them something, and sometimes there are even little timeouts when I have an aside to the audience, a sort of a, well, just between you and me moment. And at other times I'm embodying the various characters who are speaking, and at those moments I'm really inhabiting them in how they feel and what their attitude is towards what's going on.
And it would seem to me that they're inhabiting you, too, then.
Well, who knows? I'm reluctant to talk about that. I'm not thinking about the musical realization of it. You know, I'm not shaping beautiful phrases or trying to make a recital out of it. I'm simply trying to tell the story and let my voice be as useful as it can in doing that, in creating, especially in creating the feeling that there are many people in the room.
Why don't we take a break now and listen to another musical selection? What would you have in mind?
Well, I think since we've heard some of Hildegard von Bingen, there's another aspect of our ensemble's work, which has been the men's ensemble. The Sequentia has several parallel tracks, if you will. We have the ensemble of women's voices. There's an ensemble of men's voices as well. Men and women didn't sing together generally in the Middle Ages. And so, the idea of a mixed chorus is very foreign to the medieval idea of music making. And I'd like to just play a few minutes from a very, very long piece, which is a lament written by Peter Abelard of Abelard and Heloise fame, who was himself a very famous composer. He was one of the big names of the 12th century, along with Hildegard von Bingen. And he wrote, ostensibly for Heloise and her nuns, a series of biblical laments, laments sung by various figures in the Old Testament. And this one is the lament of King David for the deaths of Saul and Jonathan. He wrote a new poem in Latin. It's not the same lament as the one you can read in the Bible. It's much more personal and much more gripping. And it's in the voice of David, who's talking about playing his harp. And he's saying, I'm so sad, the only thing I can do to deal with my grief at this moment is to pick up my harp, and it gives me some solace. And we'll hear just the opening of this piece called Dolorum Solatium, or the Lament of David. And this is the men's ensemble of Sequentia. And in this ensemble, I sing, but I also play the harp.
What are the internal driving forces that fuel your passion for the discovery and performance of this music?
The central thing which always drives me is a fascination with the role of the singer in society. And by this I don't mean Pavarotti or a famous vocalist. I mean singer in the sense that in a traditional society, the singer is the repository of the group's history, the genealogies, the myths, the things that make us who we are and give us an identity. I think in modern times, blues singers might have a role like that. Certain kinds of folk singers have that role in society still today. And in the Middle Ages, it was an almost tribal, almost even shamanistic function that the storyteller and singer had in society. And that's a very powerful function to have. And it's something that, of course, we don't have anymore. It's taken away from us by our need for increasingly professional entertainment. And as we become increasingly passive and want more and more brilliant things to be shown to us, we become less and less participatory. And the idea of the singer as the central element in society, the person who knows the stories and tells the stories, is something that requires a great deal of participation and gives the listener even a sense of really belonging to that group. And it's that feeling which is the central force that drives me. Much more than, let's say, melodies or beautiful notes or high notes or vocal virtuosity. All of those things are wonderful, but they can't compare with the feeling that the singer is linked to his or her society.
Well, in your case, we're going back thousands of years in tradition, is what you're presenting to us today.
Yes, I'm trying to scratch back to a time when that was still, that situation was still alive.
If someone were to give a summary of your life, both as a performer and an individual and a scholar, what would you hope they say?
Oh, that's a good question. What would I hope they say? I would hope that they'd say that I was really honestly trying to inhabit the texts that we were singing, and that the music, the vocal melody, the use of instruments and all those things, and all the scholarship and all of that was really in the service of trying to communicate a text, an idea, and a feeling to the listeners to the point where they felt like they were a part of that process.
You mentioned earlier that the chant phenomena had peaked and pretty well gone. What do you feel the prognosis is for the early music? And early music, we're talking pre-Renaissance, I think, in this case. What do you feel the prognosis is for the future of that kind of music?
For early music?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think early music is an unnecessary term. And I think it had its usefulness for a couple of decades, and I think its usefulness is fading fast. And I would be happy to see those of us who've been put in the early music ghetto liberated from it. I think early music has become extremely recognized as a mainstream musical phenomenon, and the sort of us against them mentality, which was so prevalent for many years, is no longer meaningful. And I hope that 10 or 15 years from now, people don't even talk about early music anymore, and it's no longer an issue. That the idea of what music is has, of course, expanded enormously, and with the electronic media at our disposal, it's going to expand even more, and who knows how we're going to be listening to music 20 years from now. But I think that early music as such is going to lose its fortress identity.
Do you feel, though, that the music will stay alive and that the performance of it will expand?
The performance of it will expand enormously, but it will no longer have that stigma of being the other music, the alternative to classical music. I think, if anything, the classical, what we call classical music performance of the traditional variety will become, if anything, the specialty.
Ben, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Profiles, where we meet the person behind the persona. Our guest today has been Benjamin Bagby, medievalist, scholar, performer, teacher, lecturer, the inventive mind behind the performing groups Quencha, and an exceptional talent that has performed and lectured on Beowulf as part of the 2000-2001 Patton Lectures at Indiana University. Ben, we are really appreciative of you spending time with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This is Bob Willard. Thank you for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in February of 2001. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash. For WFIU, thanks for listening.